The shootings in El Paso and Dayton continue to dominate the news. But for how much longer, and will anything be done? Or will we be doing the same show a short time from now? Welcome. Thanks for being a part of the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. I hope you had a nice weekend. Before we get started with the conversation, I just want to remind you that you can always join in with your questions or your comments. It seems like most people enjoy emailing, so email us those thoughts and questions and comments. Our email address is tfs@wshu.org. And on Facebook, you can find us at Full Story WSHU. Now, as I mentioned at the top, we're once again revisiting gun control in our region. It's a subject we've talked about many times. Unfortunately, we're probably going to do it again in the future a number of times. We do have a number of guests for you today, and we're going to start by welcoming back Timothy Litton. He's Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development at the Georgia State University College of Law. Professor Litton, thanks for spending some time with us again. We always appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
You've written a number of books on different topics, but the one that most interests us for this program is Suing the Gun Industry. It was published, I believe, back, 2005 now?
That's right.
So you've been looking into this for a number of years, right? When you hear all the proposals after the latest shootings, what are you thinking?
Well, up until now, gun violence has really been different than most of our other social problems. In other areas, natural disasters, foodborne illness, child sexual abuse, when you have national tragedies that involve everybody and sort of shock the nation, there tends to be a breakup of the deadlock and people start to reevaluate their positions, and often there's some sort of compromise, and so we get laws that come out and we get shifting policies and there's a sort of a little bit of movement. And these large events, what social scientists call focusing events, often move policy in sort of increments. Gun violence seems to have been different over the last many decades. It seems that in the face of incredible tragedy, unimaginable mass shootings in places like Newtown or Las Vegas and now Dayton and El Paso, that instead of sort of shocking people and making them reevaluate where they are and building some sort of consensus, the tradition has been that states where people are generally in favor of gun restrictions sort of buckle down and pass marginally stricter gun laws, and states where people are opposed to those and more in favor of, liberal gun-carrying laws tend to buckle down and pass those laws, and everybody just sort of gets more set in their ways. There's been some indication since the shocking events in Dayton and especially in El Paso that it may be that the federal government at least is thinking of shaking things up and maybe making some incremental change. It looks like Republicans may be nervous about suburban Republican voters. But I think we still have to wait and see whether or not, this incredible tragedy is going to be different than the ones we've seen before and whether it's going to sort of shake up people from wherever they happen to be now and make them reevaluate their positions and maybe moderate them.
Professor, listening to you, I was thinking back to a program we did just a few weeks ago about the political polarization in this country and how blue states are becoming bluer and red becoming more red and maybe a handful or two of purple in between. And it sounds like it's very similar to what you're describing in terms of gun control.
Yes, and I think this polarization is really driven by two very different narratives about the role of guns in our society. I think for many people, guns represent really our darkest impulses and the sort of violent past of the nation and the idea that, guns are an engine of criminality. And for other people in the country, there's a different narrative altogether. It's a narrative that says, unlike Europe and Asia and pretty much and Latin America, every other place in the world, the Americans have suffered a lot of problems in our history, but we've never had a tyrannical government that sort of took over and oppressed us the way the Nazis did or the Pol Pot regime. And many people believe that's largely due to the idea that there's this ethos of widespread private firearm ownership and the idea that the people are able to be armed as a sort of symbol of our resistance to possible tyranny. And these two narratives, as you can imagine, dictate very different views about gun policy, and that has fed and fueled polarization for many decades now.
Professor Litton, you mentioned the states that really wanted gun laws will enact them. Connecticut has, New York has, but what good is a good law or set of laws enacted in one state if other states don't do the same, especially with guns? Doesn't this have to be done on a national basis?
Well, it's unclear whether that's the case. I mean, I think it may be that states, and especially, you know, regions of states like, you know, the Northeast that tend to have greater gun restrictions may actually be able to some degree, control gun violence within their jurisdictions. Of course, there's always the possibility of gun trafficking, and one can take a firearm from one place to another. But in many of the mass shootings that we've been seeing, people purchase the gun either within the state or within the same region. And so there's some reason to think that actually regional differences might make a difference. The one thing that we don't really know is that, you know, there hasn't been an enormous amount of study as to whether or not particular regions of the country suffer less because of the gun restrictions or don't suffer less gun violence because of the gun restrictions in their jurisdiction. And that's partly because research in this area has largely been starved. The federal government has not been funding research. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, has not been able to study it as a public health problem, you know, for more than a decade. And that's a big problem. There's a lot that we don't know that we would need to know to answer that question.
Huh, that's an interesting point. And we are going to be addressing that issue near the end of our program. So I hope our listeners stick around for that. It almost, again, it sounds as if you're saying that this could be fought, if you will, on a regional basis. So if states such as, let's say, New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey, if they got together to enact stricter gun laws, it would help the region as a whole.
Well, it seems that, you know, the states that you mentioned already have much stricter gun laws than many states in the South and in the Southwest. So, you know, the real question is would be to do the research to figure out whether or not the rates of violence in the various regions is attributable to differences in the law, or there may be other differences, cultural differences or other types of regional differences. A lot of that's information that we don't have. We do know some things. There's some basis for believing that certain types of gun restrictions either reduce the lethality of shootings or reduce the frequency. But again, you know, there's so much that we don't know, and it would be helpful if we were to, you know, go ahead and study this experiment where places like New York and Connecticut and New Jersey have stricter gun laws and compare that to what's going on in Louisiana and Alabama and Georgia.
Professor Linton, after everything that's happened, and you and I have spoken before, and as I said at the beginning, we've done a number of programs on this, and then you hear so many commentators say, no, this is going to be the tipping point. Change will come now. Is change going to happen?
Like I said, I think that the gun violence debate in the United States is really sui generis. It's the only area of public policy I can think of where massive national tragedy does not shake people up enough to actually make them come to some sort of compromise or agreement. We see when hurricanes come in, moderations about the idea about disaster relief, and we see new policies. When we see sexual abuse scandals, we see shifts in policy. And the same is true with, you know, widespread foodborne illness. We see reforms. We don't see that kind of change when we have mass shootings. And as I said, I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, and it may be that there's a certain amount of movement going on now in the wake of Dayton and El Paso. But the pattern in the past has been that people basically buckle down in wherever they are, and they don't move towards the middle at all.
Former Congressman Steve Israel is going to be joining us in a few moments, and he has said that the gun control lobby, not so much the NRA, but even though the NRA is part of it, that they are the ones behind this. And politically, Republicans especially cannot fight them. They cannot go against them because they're afraid of being primaried and losing their seats. Is that accurate?
I think that it's very true that the NRA and the gun industry, you know, have a strong lobbying presence in Washington and in state legislatures around the country. But I think it would be a mistake to think that what's going on here is that we're talking about powerful lobbies that don't really have a widespread constituency. I mean, I moved from New York State to Georgia a few years ago, and I can tell you there is widespread support for the idea of lowering restrictions on the ability to carry weapons publicly. I know that in Georgia, in the face of mass shootings in Florida, that the state's reaction essentially was to pass a law making it easier to carry concealed weapons in a wider variety of places. There's a very broad constituency in the United States that supports the idea that the proper response to gun violence is to allow everybody to be armed in a wider variety of venues. And so it's clear that people are worried about being primaried, but I think people are also worried about voters in their districts. There are a lot of people who cling to this narrative and believe it just as fervently as the alternative narrative, that what keeps this country from slipping into tyranny is the idea that people could go out and build an arsenal in their basement by buying AK-47s.
I've been fortunate enough to do a lot of traveling over the years, and I always tell people, I say, look, when you leave our area and you go to other parts of the United States, it's different. They have different beliefs, and you think that your way of thinking is correct, and maybe it is in your mind, but as you just said, if you go to Florida, Texas, Alabama, whatever, the thinking there is clearly different, and they believe that what they're doing is correct and the correct way to operate.
I think that's right. I mean, if you think about what people see on the news, they see stories about, you know, a takeover in Russia increasingly by Putin and the centralization of authority. They see stories about Syria where there's a central dictator who's basically killing his own people. They see stories of countries around the world, one after the other, some of which have had democratic traditions or democratic experiments, falling into authoritarianism, and it's largely because the government is, you know, exercising some sort of takeover and militarizing their power and oppressing the people. And some people in the country, when they see all that on the news, think the reason that doesn't happen in the United States is because we have such free access to firearms. Now, you may not believe that, but I think it's very important to understand that that's where the sentiment comes from. And it's not just from, you know, people who are on the right or the left. This is a widespread belief in many parts of the country, and many of the people who believe it strongly enough to go and vote on this as a top, you know, top principle or a top three principle of concern when they're deciding who they want to be their congressman or who they want to be their governor.
Timothy Litton, Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development at the Georgia State University College of Law. Professor Litton, always a pleasure. Thank you, sir. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
If you'd like to comment on today's program, you can email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. On Twitter, find us at FullStoryWSHU. And remember, all our shows are available as podcasts. You can download the full story on Google Play or on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back. It's The Full Story on WSHU, and I'd like to welcome back to the program Steve Israel. Steve Israel is a former Democratic congressman from Long Island. He served for 16 years before retiring back in 2017, and he's now running Cornell University's Institute of Politics and Global Affairs. Steve, as always, welcome back. Thanks for your time.
Oh, it's always wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
I mentioned at the top of the show that this show is now about 9 months old. And since we started, we've had, and we've talked about this issue a disturbing number of times, and the inaction on Capitol Hill. You wrote an opinion piece for USA Today, and you said the reason for the inaction is
politics. I served in Congress, as you mentioned, for 16 years. And in those 16 years, there were 52 mass shootings in the country. The Pulse nightclub in Orlando, church in Charleston, movie theater in Aurora, and, of course, Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut. And after every single one of those incidents, the most frequent question that I received, along with many of my colleagues, was, when is Congress going to do something to stop this? And, you know, this came from not Democrats, Republicans, even NRA members. And I always knew the answer to the question. The answer to the question was, it probably will not be stopped by Congress, because the tragic, maddening fact is that too many members of Congress fear the wrath of the gun lobby more than they fear a crazed gunman in a Walmart. And they'll tweet their condolences, they'll lower flags, they'll call for moments of silence, and then they wait the public out. They wait for the anguish to die down, hoping that you'll forget the last shooting and their own fecklessness.
So does the NRA own President Trump and Mitch McConnell?
I wouldn't say just the NRA. The entire gun lobby. Actually, the NRA is in a fairly weakened state right now. But I think it's misread. The political dynamic of the influence of gun advocates on Capitol Hill and in Washington is largely misread. It's not just the National Rifle Association. It is the gun manufacturers who pour extraordinary amounts of money into the NRA, into a group called Gun Owners of America, into an entire network of organizations that mobilize against any kind of sensible gun safety act. They pour money into campaigns. They pour money into super PACs. And so I think we actually give the NRA more credit than they deserve when we believe that they own President Trump or Congress or any politician. It's the gun manufacturers who are behind it all, who really put profit ahead of the public safety, in my view.
I know you say the problem is the gun lobby and politics, but you also wrote in your op-ed that the problem is voters with short memories.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I know I come off as cynical, and I sure hope I'm wrong. And maybe this time it will change, although I've heard myself say that 52 times after the 52 mass shootings in my service. But the fact of the matter is that ultimately we elect our representatives to Congress. And the fact of the matter is that there are many congressional districts that are electing people who vote against even common sense, common ground issues like strengthened background checks or banning cop-killing bullets and, or no-fly, no-buy. The fundamental problem from a political perspective is it's called voter intensity. If you are a voter who strongly believes in guns and also opposes any kind of compromise on gun safety, you will punish a member of Congress who votes against you on that one issue. But if you are a voter who supports gun safety legislation but also is concerned about climate and concerned about education and concerned about all the other issues, even if your member of Congress votes against common sense gun safety, you'll forgive him or her because maybe they're okay on other issues. So it's all about this voter intensity. And until those of us who believe in gun safety vote more intensely for or against members of Congress based on that one issue, I think you're going to see more of the same.
I read an article the other day which basically said that young Republicans are coming around to the climate crisis, and that's going to cause a big change for the future for the GOP.
Mm-hmm.
Any chance of that happening with gun control legislation?
You know, I hope so, but I don't see it yet. And here's why. Mostly as a result of congressional gerrymandering, where congressional districts are drawn not to represent a certain number of equivalent people, but to protect an incumbent, districts have gone further to the left and further to the right across America. And there's no issue that is more intense and more influential, particularly in a Republican district with a Republican primary, than guns. And so I can't tell you how many of my colleagues would say to me in the sanctity of the members-only elevator or a quiet conversation on the members-only balcony, Republicans would say to me, I wish I could vote for strengthened background checks. And I would say, well, why didn't you? Why don't you? And the answer was, because if I go home to my Republican district with a vote for background checks, I'll get primaried. And I will lose my primary. And so it goes back to what I said at the outset of this conversation. Too many of my former colleagues fear a primary more than they do a crazed gunman in a school or a shopping center or a movie theater or a church.
Along those lines, Connecticut has some of the strongest gun laws in the nation. And unfortunately, it took Sandy Hook to enact them. But if other states have weak laws and the guns can be brought into Connecticut, well, what's the point? You know, I guess I'm saying if it's not done nationally, there's always going to be a loophole someplace.
Well, you're exactly right. And, you know, unless every state who supports gun safety is willing to build a great, big, beautiful wall, as Donald Trump would say, around their borders to stop guns from coming in, these laws aren't particularly effective. Gun violence is a national epidemic. It kills 30,000 people a year. You need national, concerted, smart, sensible laws and not stovepiping laws in different states simply because guns can go from one place to the other quite easily.
Do you see a glimmer of hope in the president's latest comments about background checks?
Well, I do, but we've heard this before and have been disappointed when the anxiety and the emotion and the trauma wears off and we forget. It's not just the president who will decide whether or not a background check bill passes. It's Mitch McConnell in the Senate. The Democrats in the House of Representatives have already passed a bill for stronger background checks. It's gone to the Senate, where Mitch McConnell has just sat on it. He will not allow it to the floor for a vote. You need, if we're serious, if something's going to happen, after this horrific weekend of murders that we had, you need the Senate to pass the House bill, and that requires Mitch McConnell greenlighting it, and you need the President of the United States putting his political capital behind it and saying that he will sign it. If Donald Trump treats people, Republicans who will vote against background checks, the same way he treats Republicans who criticize him and goes out and vilifies them for opposing background checks, if he's willing to do that and spend some political capital, maybe this is the last time that we will say, hopefully this time. Maybe this time it will work.
Just on a personal note, don't you just want to scream when you hear someone say our thoughts and prayers are with you? Doesn't it just make you nuts?
You know, it made me so nuts that when I left Congress, I actually wrote a political satire, believe it or not, of that whole dynamic. I couldn't stand another moment of silence on the floor of the House without a vote to do something about it. I couldn't tolerate my colleagues tweeting and using that verbiage, you know, our hearts and prayers go out. So I wrote this novel, Big Guns, which tried to answer that question, why doesn't Congress act? And, you know, got good... good reviews, and it was my personal way of trying to answer a question that tormented me through my 16 years in Congress.
Just to end on this note, do you think that you and I will be having this same conversation in a few months from now?
Sir, I'm afraid that we will, unless Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell get into the Oval Office, shake hands, and say, we're going to pass strengthened background checks, we're going to ban cop-killing bullets, we're going to pass no-fly, no-buy. This all rests in the hands of two people, Mitch McConnell and President Trump.
Former Congressman Steve Israel. Steve, always a pleasure. Thank you, sir. We appreciate
it. Thanks so much.
And we're going to continue our discussion now on gun control legislation and what's being discussed and proposed since the latest mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton. Carrie Racion is Public Policy Assistant Professor at the University of Connecticut, and Richard Himmelfarb is a Political Science Professor at Hofstra University. Welcome both. Thanks for your time.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
If you would like to join in the conversation, you can email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org or leave us a comment on our Facebook page. We're at Full Story WSHU. Professor Himmelfarb, what's your take? You just heard Steve Israel. Is anything going to happen now in terms of gun control legislation?
I don't think much is going to happen, but you know, I would kind of go a little bit past that to questioning sort of the assumption that's attendant in this debate, which is that banning firearms, that waiting periods and the like would have any significant effect on the murder rate, on mass shootings in the United States. You know, the fact of the matter is we have something like 300 million firearms in this country. Actually, nobody knows, which should give you an idea of how many firearms there are and how difficult it would be to regulate these. We perhaps have 10 million assault weapons in this country of some type. You know, that depends on whether you want to define a semi-automatic weapon as an assault weapon. The idea that somehow we are going to ban these, that somehow a set of background checks or background check laws are magically going to change this set of circumstances is, I think, crazy. And I think that, you know, when it comes to firearms in the United States, the toothpaste is out of the tube. The idea of banning these or regulating these to any significant degree is simply not going to happen. And I think that, you know, the idea that that is going to be the fix for these mass shootings is, you know, if it is, it's not really going to solve this problem.
Professor, what you just said is very disturbing and very sad, and I'd like to devote a little bit more time to it, if you don't mind, in the next segment, because I think that's a very unique and disturbing angle. Professor Racion, I know from you and I speaking before that you want everyone to be aware of the link between domestic violence offenders and gun violence.
That's right. So first, I would like to respond that I do think that there's a role for public policy and for regulation at the state and local level, right? We talk about the gun death rate in this country as if it's there's sort of one number that describes all states, and that's not true, right? Hawaii has the lowest firearm mortality rate at 2.5 per 100,000 people, and Alaska the highest at 24.5 per 100,000 people. And then there's, you know, numbers all the way in between. So the idea that there isn't some role for regulation and policy, I think, is a bit too pessimistic. But on the topic of domestic violence, there's a huge link between domestic violence and mass shootings, and that's being, I wouldn't say ignored. I would say, to Congressman Israel's point, we have short memories, right? We always talk about the link between mass shooters and domestic violence, or some link between misogyny. And then we forget that, and we don't do anything to help domestic violence victims, who are in some way sort of our first red flag folks that can say there's a problem here. There's someone that poses not just a threat to me, but perhaps the public at large. And we can do something at protecting all of us. Right, perpetrators of domestic violence account for about 10% of all gun violence, but they account for 54% of mass shootings between 2009 and 2016, according to Everytown for Gun Safety. So there's a real disproportionate link here and a real opportunity for us to sort of find this needle in a haystack.
Professor, I have to tell you that in all the news reports that I've seen over the last week, I haven't referenced anything such as what you're saying.
Right. So El Paso, Gilroy, Dayton, all of those shooters showed signs of misogyny. If we look at the Sutherland Springs shooter, right, he was court-martialed for domestic violence. He wasn't in a federal database, and so that was a breakdown in our universal background system. The Pulse nightclub shooter abused his girlfriend. The Virginia Tech shooter had a history of harassing women. The Sandy Hook shooter, of course, shot his mother four times before going to the school. And so there's a huge link. It shows up every now and then. It comes, the New York Times, USA Today, The New Yorker have all run these stories, and they get run, or we don't talk about them very much, and then we just go on and talk about some other root cause of mass shootings. And there are, I'm sure, several causes of mass shootings, but in terms of identifying risk, looking at domestic violence shooters may be an important area that we can look to help protect not just families, but our communities.
Professor Himmelfarb, going back to what you were talking about before, Connecticut and New York have stronger gun laws nowadays. Are we seeing those laws translate into fewer gun deaths?
Well, whatever, there may or there may not be in New York, in Connecticut, but the fact of the matter is that it's difficult to show the exact link between these gun laws and deaths. Again, there are almost 300 million firearms in circulation. There are, again, something on the order, and again, we don't know, of 10 million semi-automatic weapons that are in possession of the public. Now, if you want to basically overhaul the Second Amendment, if you want to repeal the Second Amendment, then perhaps we could do something about this. I agree with Brett Stevens, who wrote in the New York Times that we may have to repeal the Second Amendment. I understand that. I don't agree with it, but at least I think that that's an intellectually honest argument for what we have to do if we're really going to address this problem. Things like background checks will maybe do something at the margins, but if we think that they are going to significantly decrease murder, and particularly mass murder in this country, I think people are deluding themselves.
Professor Racian, I just want to give you 30 seconds before we take a break just to respond to what Professor Himmelfarb had to say, and then we'll come back and we'll continue the conversation.
I respectfully disagree. My own work looking at the Gun Control Act expansion of 1996, which created background checks for domestic violence misdemeanors, resulted in about a 17% reduction in intimate partner homicides. So I don't call that a move on the margin. I think that's important. And again, it's only looking at one type of offender or person at risk of committing a firearm homicide.
But with the 30 seconds that we have, what do you think when you hear Professor Himmelfarb say, look, there's so many guns out there nowadays, what are you supposed to do? How are you going to round up all these guns?
Well, I don't think the goal is to round up all the guns. I think the goal is to think about who's dangerous with the guns and make sure that the folks that have guns are responsible gun owners, that those guns are being stored safely when not in use, that we're looking at permit, that we have a you know, some sort of, I would say, law enforcement that can respond when we do see that someone who's at risk of perpetrating firearm violence has guns. Mass shootings make up 4% of firearm deaths in this country. I'm interested in reducing mass shootings because they're heartbreaking, but I'm also interested in reducing the other 96% of firearm-related deaths as well.
Professor Carrie Racion and Professor Richard Himmelfarb, they're going to stay with us through the break and into the next segment. I hope you stay with us also. And if you would like to comment on today's program, email us, please. We're at tfs@wshu.org. One last break. We'll be right back. It's the full story on WSHU. I'm Ron Robiak. Professors Racion and Himmelfarb are with us for a few more minutes, but for just a moment, we want to bring in Peter Brown. Peter is the assistant director of the Quinnipiac University poll, and they have some numbers which relate to our conversation today. Hi, Peter. How are you?
Good afternoon.
What have you been asking registered voters?
Well, what we've been asking voters on gun control is pretty standard across the board. We tend to ask, there are two questions that get the most attention. We ask voters whether they think that background checks should be required for those buying firearms. And this is an issue in which there is almost universal acceptance. Well over 90% of Americans say they favor such background checks for those buying weapons. But on the broader question of is stricter gun control a good idea, where you stand on the issue actually revolves on where you sit. That is, depending on where you are geographically. Supporters of gun control and support for gun control is much stronger, obviously, in the West, in the Rocky Mountain states, and in much of the South, whereas those who are less supportive tend to be The more supportive you are, you live in the South or the Rockies.
So if you want more gun control, you basically would live in the Northeast. You want to live in Connecticut, New York,
right.
Something
you
like that. If you want
that.
Less control, you're going to be down South, Florida, Alabama, Texas, and so on.
Correct. And here's a number that shows this pretty well, actually. Voters essentially on a national basis favor stricter gun control laws by 2-1 almost. Voters in a state like Texas are different. They are 50-50 or close to 50-50 on the same issue. So geography plays a bigger role on this issue than many other issues in public discourse today.
All right, so just to repeat the numbers, because I'm going to have the professors who are our guests, going to have them comment on it. In about 94% from the numbers that I saw previous to this, about 94% across the country are in favor of more background checks, while stricter gun control depends where you live. If you're from the Northeast states or maybe California, something like that, you want more gun control. If you're from down South or the Southeast, no, not so much.
Right. Well, that's on an overall basis. There are obviously no exceptions to that rule.
Peter Brown, thank you, sir. We appreciate your time today. Quinnipiac University poll. Thanks, Peter.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Be well. All right. We're going to get some comment on that now from Carrie Racion, who is Public Policy Assistant Professor at the University of Connecticut, and Richard Himmelfarb, Political Science Professor at Hofstra University. Professor Racion, let me start with you. Do those numbers surprise you in any way?
No, they don't surprise me, perhaps because I've seen similar numbers, but also because, I think we've heard lots of times that people just want common sense gun sort of legislation, and background checks seem like the most common sense thing we can do. So it doesn't surprise me that we're looking at 94% approval there on a national scale. And it doesn't surprise me that where you live has a large role to play in what you think about gun control. Right, I'm from Texas, right, originally. I now live in Connecticut, but I'm from Texas. And guns are a part of life there. They are, you know, much more sort of recreational. People also have them for their personal safety, what they believe to be their personal safety, in a way that Connecticut just doesn't seem to sort of have that same cultural perspective. And so, no, that doesn't surprise me at all.
Professor Himmelfarb?
It doesn't surprise me either. People who tend to be most supportive of gun owners' rights tend to be people who live in more rural states, tend to think about firearms as both a means of self-defense and as something that they use for recreational purposes. You know, I think the vast majority of the guns in this country are owned by about one-third of the citizenry who may have 5-10 firearms, maybe even more, and who just look at this as part of their daily life and who feel threatened when they hear politicians talk about somehow taking them away or regulating them or making it more difficult to obtain them.
But Professor Racine, what I'm having trouble wrapping my brain around is if those numbers, which have been consistent for quite a number of years now, 94% want more background checks. Why isn't this getting passed?
Well, I mean, I think for starters, there's two ways of getting things passed, right? Many states do have something close to universal background checks at the state level, Connecticut, New York being two of those states. And so it's not that it's not getting passed, it's that it's not getting passed at a federal level. And so there's a distinction there that I think is important. I think it's exactly what former Congressman Israel was saying. It's about voter intensity. It's about voter preferences. It's about single-issue voters in a lot of ways. And so I think your previous commenter was really spot on as far as that relates. What is surprising to me about those numbers is if we think about the states that are the most reluctant to pass what we would consider sort of restrictive gun control laws, they are the states with the highest firearm mortality rates, right? Tennessee, Arkansas, Mississippi, Missouri, Louisiana, Montana, Alabama, et cetera, have the highest firearm rates, and they are the states with the fewest gun control laws, what we would consider to be gun control laws. I think that's a paradox, and I think there needs to be conversation, and I think this is a place where research can fill the conversation to think about, are we safer with more guns or fewer guns? And we don't have good research to answer that, but until we do, people sort of rely on what makes them feel safer, and that motivates their voting, it motivates their habits, it motivates their culture, et cetera. And I think that's an area where research can be helpful, where we haven't been helpful for a variety of reasons to date.
Professor Himmelfarb, you should know that on the last program that we did about gun control, we had a representative of the Gun Owners of America on the air with us. And in part, he said the media was responsible for the mass shootings because of the way they covered it, the publicity, the headlines, the TV coverage. What do you think when you hear something like
well,
this?
Well, I believe that's true. I believe that one of the reasons why we've seen this increase in mass shootings, or why they appear to be more frequent, is that they are more heavily reported, they are more publicized, and one of the things we know about these people who commit these mass shootings is that at least some significant number want the sort of glory, I use that term, you know, loosely, that goes with murdering, with engaging in mass murder. Now, again, the question is, the public policy question is, what are you going to do about that? We have a First Amendment. We're not going to certainly, I would not recommend, nor I don't think would anybody recommend, that we basically shut MSNBC and Fox News down when these events occur so that they couldn't report about these things. But I think that one of the reasons why these events are happening is because it's basically game on, and these shooters know that when they engage in these types of heinous crimes, they're going to get a heck of a lot of publicity, and the country's basically going to stop what it's doing and follow what's happening. So I don't know how you remove yourself from that or how you stop that cycle in a country with a free media and, you know, the First Amendment.
Professor Raycian, you've been studying this for a number of years now. You must have a theory as to why we continue to grapple with this problem. Do you?
I think we continue to grapple with this problem for many of the reasons we've already said. But, you know, I think we are reluctant to remove the means, right? Media or no media, if a gun that had the, you know, capacity to kill 20 people in a short amount of time or produce massive injuries in a short amount of time were not available, it would not matter what the media response was. It wouldn't happen. And so I think this is where policy comes in. I think we have to look at ways to remove guns from people who don't need guns that kill that many people or injure that many people in a short amount of time. And particularly domestic violence offenders shouldn't have access to those guns, or people that have come on other sort of at-risk lists that we may have, whatever they may be. I think we should have an exhaustive search of what those are, and it would not matter what the media response were if the means did not exist. The means matter.
Professor Himmelfarb, you know, I didn't phrase it properly with Professor Raycian. I guess I'm asking, what is there about the American character that makes us continue to grapple with this for so many decades now?
It's an interesting question. You know, I think that some part of this has to do with the fact that, unlike all of the other countries that we're typically compared to, we have a Second Amendment that is in our Constitution that protects the right to own a firearm for self-defense and essentially for recreation, too. And other countries, you know, such as, you know, for example, Australia, which have somewhat successfully banned firearms, are much smaller countries who don't have that written into their constitution. And, you know, I think that one of the key questions is that if we, you know, how would you possibly regulate firearms in a country of 300 million people where there's basically at least one firearm for every man, woman, and child? How do you go about doing that in the presence of this Second Amendment right, which has been upheld as recently as, you know, the last, you know, 15 years by the United States Supreme Court?
Richard Himmelfarb, political science professor at Hofstra University, and Kerry Raycian, public policy assistant professor at the University of Connecticut. Kerry, I'm so sorry. I'm just out of time, but please, both of you, come back soon, and we could expand the conversation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Now, for the last few minutes of our broadcast today, we're going to be joined by Dr. Hannah Sachs. Dr. Sachs is the co-founder of the Massachusetts General Hospital Gun Violence Program. The reason we're calling on Dr. Sachs, and we only have a limited period of time here, is because even though New York and Connecticut have made great strides, maybe there's something going on in Massachusetts that the other states should be considering. Dr. Sachs, I know you're very busy. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Give us a quick explanation, please, of what you're doing.
Absolutely. So thanks for looking towards us here in Massachusetts. But right here, we have launched it. I work at Mass General Hospital, and our hospital this June launched a Center for Gun Violence Prevention. And it's really more than a statement, but really an investment in resources that we're going to treat gun violence like the medical and public health problem that it is, and that this issue is too urgent to wait for federal funding that's really been absent for decades in this space, and this issue is just too urgent to keep waiting.
So if I could simplify it, you're basically collecting data?
Yeah, we have a mix. So our organization, our center, has really three pillars. One is clinical care and education. How do we empower frontline clinicians to incorporate violence prevention methods into their care? And really the reason is because I am not alone. I'm a physician, and in no part of my training was I ever taught how to talk to patients about firearm safety, how to think about violence prevention when I'm talking with my patients. And for an issue that affects so many of our patients, with 40,000 people dying a year, probably more than 100,000 being injured, that's just inexcusable. And that can be solved with clinical training. So we've launched a real clinical training program teaching people how to have informed, culturally competent conversations about firearm safety with patients when it's relevant. And that really is the beginning of what we see as a culture change in our profession. The second pillar, the second focus of our center is, just like you're saying, is research, and really trying to step in and fill the void where CDC and other federal funders have not acted over the last couple of decades. You know, for example, no one's collecting comprehensive data on non-fatal firearm injuries. And those, from where I sit as a physician, those are our lifelong patients in many ways, people who are being injured by firearms and survive. And we need to understand how to take better care of that group of patients and how to prevent those injuries. And then the third, which is really a critical mission here, is our community engagement focus, and how do we connect the hospital system and the public health system with people in the community that have been doing this work and been in this space for decades, and how do we all work together and really build support networks across our city and across the region.
Dr. Sachs, why isn't this being done on a federal level?
You know, we're hoping that we're part of the beginning. I think there are a lot of groups that are starting this work. I think things often work better when there's sort of a federal mandate from CDC or the National Institutes of Health, which usually fund a lot of the research and work across medicine. But that's just absent here. And this issue is just too urgent to wait. So a lot of us in the medical profession, a lot of us in the medical community are trying to get started and to do that work. And so, you know, it's going to be a little bit more patchwork at first, but there's a lot of people across a lot of cities in this country that are really rolling up their sleeves and starting to do the work and have been doing this work. And I think that momentum is going to build.
Dr. Sachs, I'm so happy to hear that you're doing this, but I have to admit I was surprised because I just assumed that this was being done on the national level for decades now. I mean, why wouldn't it be?
Yeah, and I think that is a real key point that some of your earlier guests alluded to, that usually the way this works is CDC or NIH sets funding priorities and empowers clinicians. More than two decades ago, or about two decades ago, really CDC stopped funding this line of research, and that was in response to the firearm lobby and others, but that money for this research was just really stripped from the federal budget. And that absolutely needs to be restored. I think that's a high priority, but we have to find other ways to fund it in the meantime.
Dr. Sachs, I know you're pretty busy nowadays, but if any health officials in the New York, Connecticut area are listening to this, and if they want to contact you to find out how to do this down here, are you open to that?
Absolutely. We need all hands on deck to work on this problem together. So I look forward to getting those calls.
Dr. Hannah Sachs, who is the co-founder of the Massachusetts General Hospital Gun Violence Program. Dr. Sachs, thank you, and I wish you the best of luck.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. If you would like to comment on today's program, you can email us. We are at tfs@wshu.org. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Full Story WSHU, and many are now finding us on our updated Facebook page. So you could also find us there, Full Story WSHU. And if you would like to leave us a voicemail, our number is 833-CALL-TFS. That number is 833-225-5837. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about the opioid epidemic in our region. We'll give you an update as to what's going on, and I hope you tune in for that. That's going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, and Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.